Welcome to Inquiring Minds, the Writing and Literacy SIG podcast. My name is Tori Pennington, and I am your host.
And my name is Holly Riesco, and I'm your co-host.
The Writing and Literacy SIG podcast aims to highlight scholarship, discuss contemporary issues, and engage in conversation with SIG members and the greater writing and literacy field. Through a robust dialogue, we hope to ignite nationwide discussion amongst faculty and graduate students concerning topics that are timely and pertinent to the scholarship of writing literacies and the broader field of education.
On this episode of Inquiring Minds, we have four distinguished guests joining us to discuss translanguaging across literacies and the possibilities it poses for the landscape of literacy research.
We have Dr. Lindsay Rowe from Clemson University, and Dr. Andy Zapata of the University of Missouri.
We also have Dr. Patrick Ann Smith of University of South Florida and Dr. Faith Boschman from Boston College.
These scholars were selected to engage in this conversation because their work pushes on the boundaries of named languages through orientations such as translanguaging and raciolinguistics. We'll begin by asking our guests to define translanguaging, how it relates to multiple literacies, and your research.
Dr. Zapata, you can start the conversation if you would like.
Oh boy. Thank you all for having us. It's such a pleasure to be with you all today, and very exciting for me to be here with Faith and Petrianne and Lindsay also. So thanks again for gathering us. I guess I'm thinking you all want us to start first with this conversation around how we're thinking about translanguaging, how we're interpreting it. Just broadly, I think of translanguaging really as that ability to fluid, that skill set, and also a pedagogy where we're fluidly moving across languages and really accessing our fullest linguistic repertoire. So really drawn to the work of Ofelia Garcia as just someone who's opening up that conversation for us for such a long time now. I always think of a metaphor that Ramon Martinez shared with me once. He said, why are we denying our students their fullest access to their toolkit? You know, why are we saying they can only use a hammer to complete some endeavor when they have hammer and sledgehammer and screwdriver and so many tools at their fingertips? So, how can we really support students' access to and uses of all of these tools? And I think that's what a translanguaging lens allows us to keep in mind. How are we really supporting students' access to their fullest toolkit? I don't know if anyone has anything to add to that too. I have lots of other things to say too, but I'll stop there to give everyone else a chance to pop in as well.
It was, I'll jump in here. It was sort of really great to hear you talk about the tools and the metaphor that Ramon Martinez provided. I've used a lot of his work to inform my thinking around translanguaging, but also around language in general, the idea of disrupting this sort of notion around English learners, and in addition to his work, the work of Nelson Flores around language architecture specifically came to mind as you talked about the tools. And so for me, translanguaging has really sort of come to reflect that capacity to manipulate these various modalities and to be able to extend even beyond the linguistic modalities to other sorts of broader semiotic tools that students tend to possess, and to consider how those modalities are racialized, which I extended in the work of Nelson Flores to think of ratio-semiotic architecture. How are these modalities racialized, and how does that then intersect with students' personhoods? And in what ways do we make spaces in classrooms to acknowledge this, but also with standards and with institutional norms to create opportunities for linguistic and broader semiotic repertoires that various types of personhoods present so that they can become what we think of as mainstream? How do we center multilingual, multicultural, multiracial norms in our practice. And so that's kind of where I'm thinking with these ideas, as you mentioned, with Ofelia Garcia starting a lot of this conversation from that Welsh sort of word, translanguaging, and then moving, you know, through ways, for example, connotations of translanguaging practice, but also Jeff McSwan coming into that conversation. So I've spent a lot of time engaged with some of these tensions around how translanguaging is positioned in the field and how we can broaden our understandings of what it looks like and feels like for students.
I think it's also really helpful to think about translanguaging as a pedagogy, and how do we develop teacher stances towards translanguaging in classrooms? How do we think about their sociopolitical and sociocultural knowledges? And I've thought about that both in work with in-service teachers as well as in teacher education. I think with pedagogies too, thinking about sort of all the sort of components of those, with the stance as well as design and shift. And so what does that enactment look like in classrooms when teachers are moving from maybe a monocultural classroom ecology and language ideology to a multilingual one, and thinking about how is it that we can best support teachers in making that shift as well, I think is really important.
Yeah, wow, great thoughts. I would echo a lot of these thoughts. For me, I think about translanguaging both as a theory of language and a pedagogy. And I think what's exciting is I feel like there's a lot of area for theoretical expansion around translanguaging, or a lot of scholars doing that work. So I feel like I often open a new piece on translanguaging and it just expands my thinking. And so a couple areas that I've been grappling with recently are thinking about collective or collaborative translanguaging and how language resources are shared across communities and across people, particularly in multilingual spaces, like the classrooms where I often am working with teachers and students. I think there's also exciting work going on around translanguaging and multimodality and expanding beyond linguistic modes to think more broadly. I think that there's also space for thinking about the languaging aspect of translanguaging and looking specifically at language interaction and what language interactions people construct together when invited, allowed, supported to use multiple modes, language resources, and what that means in a space when we are constrained by broader ideologies and policies, and how languaging at a local classroom level can perhaps create change in those spaces. So,
yeah, I agree, Lindsay. It is such an exciting time to be in this field. I think about when I first started, just leaving my program, 2012, 2013, and Suresh Kanagaraja had just published this piece on translingual literacies. Like, oh, this is so interesting. As someone interested in that intersection of the multilingual and the multimodal, and not quite satisfied with the theories I had been thinking with, that was treating them as separate and not really as deeply entangled. But at the time, that's what we were doing, really looking at each area quite distinctly in our literacy research, and to think about where we are now. The preponderance of scholarship that's really taken us to deeper areas of study at that intersection of the multilingual, multimodal. It's very, very exciting. I'm personally right now still situated in that work in translingual literacies. I really am someone interested in the text production that happens in these spaces where that fluid movement across not only languages, but language varieties as well, is happening with, students and teachers work with other material, discursive matter as well. It's been really fascinating to see, okay, what are the conditions that really nurture these translanguaging spaces and translingual literacies? I see myself really seeing how translanguaging and the scholarship on translingual literacies certainly complement one another, And then also see myself situating my work in one area more than another, depending on the kinds of research questions that I have.
If I can just jump in and say that I like that you mentioned, Angie, about the language varieties, and, you know, spent a lot of time with translanguaging, thinking about, yeah, as a Caribbean national working with Black Caribbean transnational youth around what we tend to think of as language varieties and how they're positioned. And so it's great to hear you talk about that, because what I saw was students translanguaging with Englishes in the Caribbean, in the US, as they crossed boundaries, as they became racialized. And I show some of this in my book, Black Immigrant Literacies, and really try to grapple with what actually is happening here, even within what we think of as a named language, English, but you know, the intralinguistic variations in how students' personhoods are positioned as they are intertwined or entangled with these language practices. And then how does that help us to think about translanguaging as a theory, as a concept that moves beyond just thinking about the very same named languages that it tends to push back on, mm-hmm. as a way to recognize that it is not necessarily just the abstract named practices that deserve attention in terms mm-hmm. of pushback, but the structural elements from mm-hmm. a notion such as critical race theory that positioned these languages as detrimental in the first place. So I find myself going back to the source, the basis, the foundation mm-hmm. of the need to push back with these policies, but also thinking, how do we alienate some students who are mm-hmm. themselves translanguaging with mm-hmm. Spanish varieties or English varieties or other varieties? Because Englishes themselves are unequally positioned, and the power dynamics that they hold then get completely sidelined. And mm-hmm. so I think there is a need to, at least as I look through this in my Cambridge University Press book that I'm working on right now, or actually finalizing, and that's coming out this year, I'm trying to sort of ask us as a field, even myself, right, to rethink how we're conceptualizing translanguaging practice, and then to go back to, you know, the foundational elements that create these power dynamics, these unequal power dynamics in the first place.
You've all talked about personhood and identity and translanguaging as being interconnected. I was wondering if you could all expand on the intersection of those three ideas.
Yeah, I think of the way our language really influences the way we perceive ourselves, and how others perceive us. Our language, we are marked in many ways by our language, and the way we move through the world, which is why it's so essential that we begin to embrace linguistic diversity rather than suppressing it, because the implications of our developing personhood and identities are in turn deeply impacted by the way we receive ourselves and the way we are received in the world. I think of a conversation I often have with teachers who are just entering into these shifting spaces in their classroom where they're welcoming refugee immigrant families, and for the first time encountering, you know, multilingual, bilingual families. You know, we are socialized into our ways with words by our families, by our communities, by our peers. So when we correct children and we say, actually, that's wrong, you shouldn't say it that way, we are telling children that their families are wrong. We are telling them that their community, their peers are wrong. So there's quite a bit of work we have to do to recondition our identities as teachers, as not language police, to shift away from that linguistic shaming, but to really begin to do the work ourselves as educators, to you know, again, embrace linguistic diversity and do the work of interrogating our bias, our own biases about how we perceive our own languages, as well as the way we receive others. So again, deeply entangled language and identity. We can think of the work of Gloria and Saldúa, in, you know, as a place to start for that as well. You know, I am my language.
When I think about how personhood is typically constructed in English medium classrooms, it's often that unmarked monolingual norm. And I've really been working a lot with pre-service teachers and with in-service teachers to think about how can we change the way that personhood is socially constructed among people in interaction in classrooms in ways that reflect multilingual students and their linguistic and cultural knowledges. And so one of the ways in which we've been thinking about that is through translanguaging read alouds, where our teachers are engaging in reading aloud a linguistically diverse text to children. And I think that having characters in a story that are multilingual really provides teachers with that pedagogical resource to engage in that. And so one of the examples I'm thinking of is a paraprofessional teacher who is reading the book, My Poppy Has a Motorcycle. And she started off by, you know, saying, looking at the translingual title and showing like, look, in this book, it says my in English. And then she says, but it's also in Spanish. And her eyes widen and she gets really excited. And then she points to the Spanish word poppy. And then she switches to Spanish to say to the kids, you know, you can talk to me in Spanish or we can talk together in Spanish. And that, you know, saying that is not necessarily humorous, but the kids responded. They started giggling and smiling and looking at each other. And they were sort of marking like this notion of personhood, this multilingual notion of personhood that this teacher is proposing really sort of transgresses this monolingual space, and just being so excited by that in their reading. And I think it sort of reminded me of a phrase that Michiko Hakita and Ramon Martinez talked about, that this idea that these sort of dominant forms of personhood, these monolingual forms, they beat students and teachers to the interactional scene, right? They're already there. And so these kids' responses were really showing their joy and that this multilingual notion of personhood was being constructed among them, but also sort of their reaction to this is being done in this space, right? And that feels really different than, you know, the erasure of our linguistic resources or the ways in which personhood is typically constructed. So I think ways in which we can work with teachers to think about what are those pedagogical resources that we can draw upon to broaden notions of personhood in schooling are really important.
Yeah, like Faith, I've thought a lot about how personhood is interactionally constructed through the ways people talk about people, right? Talk about one another, talk about themselves, talk about groups of people. And that this means it can be deeply entrenched, but also that our actions can change things, right? So in classrooms, thinking about how teachers and students talk about language users, themselves as language users, authors as language users, bilingual authors, and together co-construct ideologies, conceptualizations of personhood. What does it mean to be a bilingual author? Is that, what is that? Have you heard of that before? Have we ever talked about that in school? And that you are one too, right? So thinking through these shared ways of talking about language users and opening space for that in English medium spaces where it's often just assumed that we're all going to be speaking some quote unquote standardized version of English, right? That's the norm. And that is for me the impetus behind this work, right? So how are kids feeling in schools? What messages are sent to them about their language use and therefore their personhood, right? Those things are inextricably linked. And then I think the challenge is broadening this beyond a single classroom, right? So a lot of the work I've done looks at a classroom space and thinks about how a teacher and students co-construct these things. And then scaling that up to change our systems is I think a real challenge.
So I'm so excited to hear all of the connections that y'all are making, because it really is so linked to, you know, a lot of the work I've been doing. And, you know, when I heard Faith talk about, you know, the personhood processes that we construct as the base, right, from which everyone then decides to perform the self, you know, really powerful, because when I think back on students that I work with, the Black Caribbean transnational students, we see instances where some of these students are crossing boundaries, their personhood's being racialized based on their semiotizing and translanguaging practices. But even within the groups that they you know belong, such as the group racialized as Black, they are being told how to structure that personhood in ways that allow them not to belong to racial groups, you know, to identify with racial groups where they think they belong, and then having to figure out, well, how do they get to manifest a language or a semiotic repertoire that fits with a group that accepts them? I mean, there is so much going on there with how they perform personhood to get into spaces as they migrate from one, you know, ethnic enclave of the Caribbean, for instance, to what is a white, you know, Black-white binary sort of context of the U.S. And when I hear Lindsay talk about teaching students to think about how they think about race and language and culture through what I call a transrace linguistic approach out of extending the work of Jonathan Rosa and Nelson Flores, I think about how those metalinguistic practices, metacultural and metaracial, are necessary at the classroom level, Lindsay, to sort of really give students an access to these assets that they possess and that they use every day, and that help them to structure their personhoods in ways that do not allow them to feel alienated. But I also think of the institutional level as well. And so showing teachers, at least in the book, Black Immigrant Literacies, how do you recraft every standard so that you are operating with the standard from a multilingual, from a multicultural, from a multiracial norm, and showing teachers how to do that in a lesson plan, in a unit plan, in different levels of planning, and then telling policymakers, hey, look, this is possible. You know, we have these ELA standards that still operate from this dominant norm, I argue, that is sort of a neutral, unspoken assumption that's always there. And then how do we shift these institutionally leveled norms to allow for the personhoods to flourish and to thrive in the ways that they were meant to be? So it's just quite fascinating to listen to the discourses and to see how they are all intertwined, and they each bring a different perspective to the table.
Absolutely, Petra, and the arc of the development of this translanguaging stance to ultimately impact policy. I feel like that's what you just took us through. And I step into this thing really wanting to encourage viewers, teachers in particular, that this is work that can happen with our youngest children. This can, if what does it mean to begin these conversations around language, identity, power with young children, and beginning that now, the implications are tremendous. What we're finding is that young children are so excited and able to talk about the linguistic repertoires that they bring, to admire and have curiosity for the linguistic repertoires that their peers bring as well. What does it mean to bring this language awareness that will eventually hopefully transition into critical language awareness with young children? It is possible, and we're really excited about you know, what we're seeing right now in the scholarship that's just beginning to look at what are the conditions that are cultivating these conditions where young children can explore, you know, language awareness. What are the commitments that teachers are bringing? Because that's absolutely essential as well. What are the classroom practices and so on? So if we're really with that commitment we have to undoing or resisting these language binaries that persist in schools, I really want to emphasize the need for this work to begin with our youngest children as well.
I think building on something that Angie said, really listening to children is so important. And I think that was one of the things that came out of some of the work and shifting to translanguaging and literacy instruction, was that it provided students, in this case, in an English-only state where English was dominant in the school, to really advocate their cultural, their linguistic, and their textual rights in classrooms. So I think because teachers were reading these linguistically diverse texts, it really provided openings for them to say, wow, like, I love it when I see a character's name that reflects my own in a book, or, you know, why don't we have the Mexican flag in our school, right? I can see it here in this book. I want, you know, that's really important to me. There was a teacher reading Vamos, Let's Go Eat, and a child said, you know, multiple children said, oh, I really like this book. And, but one child was silent. And when the teacher asked, like, you know, if you like the book or not, and the student said, I really want this book to be all in Spanish. And so the student was able to say, like, I want to be able to read this with my mom and share it with my mom. And so this teacher didn't share the linguistic background of the student. And so she said, I don't know Spanish well enough to read all of this book to you in Spanish, but let's take a time to read it together. And then we can also read it together with your mom. So finding those spaces, but then also kind of pointing to the need for having lots of different kinds of texts in classrooms, texts that are linguistically diverse, and then texts that are only in English or only in students' heritage languages, I think is so important as well.
This is so great. And if you can just allow me to respond to Faith's comment, because I really like that you talked about the text and you talked about, you know, seeing children in these kinds of ways, because it reminds me also that children are texts. They are, we are reading them into the world as teachers, or we are teaching teachers how to read them into the world too. And so thinking back to the past that a lot of the immigrants and transnational youth come with, and how do we help teachers to see these pasts and to see language encapsulated within these pasts as a way of reading them and reading the students into the worlds that these teachers tend not to be familiar with, is something that I think of a lot. I think about how, you know, authentic narratives, for instance, can make more visible the child as a whole being and show how their past are intertwined with what we tend to see here in the US, and how those past have language practices and ideologies themselves that the child has been entrenched in and that the child brings to the classroom. And so you said listening to students, and Angie said it as well, but I think we do need to create you know, authentic narratives that show students pre-migration, at least in the case of my research, pre-migration, what do they look like in terms of the linguistic practices? And then helping teachers to see, you know, see the child as a whole child, and not just the language piece that I'm teaching over here on a Monday morning. Mm-hmm. Just wanted to add that piece as well.
Yeah, it's a reminder, Petrian, that we have to situate this work in continuing to develop our own perspectives and learning, recognizing the limits of our own knowledge as teachers of language, and continuing to read and do the work around translanguaging, around the relationship of language and identity, that the work of being a language teacher has to be nested in our developing orientations to critical language awareness, to linguistic diversity, because we can do all these wonderful practices, right? We can do all these beautiful things. We can flood our rooms with beautiful texts that reflect different languages. But without that orientation, ideology, belief about why and the value of linguistic diversity, and without a justice-oriented critical or ethics orientation, to what end? To what end? So there's ongoing work that we have to engage in when we think about classroom practices, again, that really are going to elevate and amplify children's growing identities as language users as well. Yeah,
Holly and I are taking major notes over here on the side. This has been such a great informative conversation for us to be a part of. Thank you so much for all of your sharing and thoughts and piggybacking off of one another. So we're kind of hearing this undercurrent in your talks about joy and the place of laughter, and how opening up these translanguaging spaces can really affirm all of our students. And many great resources were shared, but if anyone wants to expand or share more about classroom practices that could promote translanguaging and transsemiotizing, please feel free to share.
I'll build a bit off Angie's comment, which also, Angie, when I think at one point you wrote something that talked about conditions of possibility. Mm-hmm. And that has been really helpful for me in also thinking about within a classroom space, what conditions of possibility can we cultivate to support this work, right? And so I think of both the teacher role and the student role, and if we're constructing something, they're both vital, right? Kids have to also be participating in this work. But from the teacher perspective, kind of building on what we were just talking about, something that I found helpful to talk with pre-service teachers about and to view myself as is, the idea that we're all language learners, and that unknowing or willingness to learn is actually a really powerful, valuable stance to bring to the classroom to model. And it releases you of the burden, right? You don't have to know everything. And in fact, it is powerful to learn from and with students, to add to our collective language repertoire, to model what that looks like. And then I found in my own work in English medium spaces where we're really trying to push against entrenched practices and ideologies that talking with kids about reasons why we would compose multilingually is really important. So naming them, naming why do authors include bilingual texts? Are you addressing a bilingual audience? Are the characters bilingual? Is it a bilingual setting? Do you just want to because it's fun and it adds depth to your story? Like speaking through these reasons with kids is important in order to give a reason why, and because it can be hard work too. And then offering the supports, peer supports, teacher supports, digital tool supports, to come alongside kids and not just issue the invitation and leave it hanging, right? Offer the supports and then recognize when kids do the work, allow them to share with each other, to talk with each other, to share with families, broader community members, recognize the multilingual work going on in the classroom space, and then repeat, right? Building these links across time, reinforce practices or create and construct practices. So a one-time invitation is not enough here, right? This is a cultural shift within the classroom space that starts with the teacher and with kids and has to be built on across time. But the encouragement there is that you don't have to know it all, right? It starts with you accepting, reflecting on your own positionality, what you do and don't know and would like to learn, and modeling that for kids.
Thank you so much for sharing that, Lindsay. As I listened to you, I was really just struck by the metalinguistic work that has to happen with students in metacultural, metaracial work, and how that maybe can even be centered in teacher practice, right? How do we get teachers to think about the metalinguistic, metacultural, metaracial personifications that they're bringing to the table? How do we get them to do that work? Because a lot of the times I think we expect things of teachers with practices, as Angie mentioned earlier, that assume that they've done all of this wonderful PhD work that we've done and decentered all these ideologies. And unfortunately, it's not always the case, right? So they have to go through their questioning, they're challenging. And then as they do that, they become capable of embodying this work and doing the things, I think, and facilitating these why conversations that you mentioned, Lindsay, that get the students in classrooms to themselves embody a stance that hopefully in the next 20 years, at least I'm very hopeful, as Angie said, we'll see sort of teachers taking up positions in classrooms that naturally default to this multilingual, to this multicultural, to this multiracial norm in all of their practices. Again, it brings me back to, avoiding the trap of, divide and conquer politics that tells us to attack named languages or attack certain languages. It is the systems, right, that underlie, Englishes, for instance, or a certain type of English that have created these challenges. And so we want to be able to position teachers to have these why conversations that you mentioned, and to position it from a place of system versus, oh, English is bad, this type of English is bad. When what we really want students to be able to do is to draw from whatever repertoires that they have at their disposal to make sense with purpose, the lives that they're trying to pave in the world. I think, I'm just going to add one more piece here in terms of the practical mechanisms that can be used by teachers. I suggest looking at Black immigrant literacies in the Reading Teacher, the article that sort of talks about legitimizing unbroken Englishes, supporting translanguaging with Englishes, cultivating holistic literacies, and building local global connections to show how the Sankofa, past, present, and future, are all intertwined. I think that there is a lot of opportunity for us to look at the tiers of this process in terms of how the levels of translanguaging can be facilitated across teacher preparation programs, and then with teachers and in-service sorts of contexts, but also with students. And so there are multiple layers of this that we need to get to, but I'm very hopeful as we work with all of these wonderful concepts that you are each drawing from, that we can together create a better future for our wonderful babies.
I love it. Patrianne, I want to echo what you just shared and build upon what I hear you perpetuating, is this notion of language study as a practical approach in the classroom. It's such a powerful medium for language and literacy learning. If we think about what we see happening right now in our classrooms around literacy learning, it brings a very narrow standardizing English phonics, phonemic awareness approach to reading, I think about the limitations for our bi-multilingual students. When we approach literacy learning and have a significant component around language study, the intellectual demand is so much greater. Whereas in the previous structure I just shared, we're really just asking children to replicate one form, just memorize and replicate a form. But when we think about language study, we're asking, again, the intellectual demand is so much greater. We're asking them to truly think about function, semantics, structure, identity. I mean, there's so many more components involved that our children are very capable of doing. So there's so much untapped potential in the work around language study and thinking about it in all its iterations towards a critical language awareness for our students. It's very exciting to think about. I also want to back up a little bit and just share. I know that in my own work and in my recent book, Deepening Student Engagement with Diverse Picture Books, one of the things I talk about aren't just classroom practices, but the way classroom practices are deeply, again, entangled with classroom conditions, teachers' commitments, and collaborations. So that's just a nudge I want us to keep thinking about, that again, these practices are deeply rooted in the belief systems that we bring to the work as well. So it's just holding myself accountable to that always. You know, yes, these practices are very important. And how are they reflective of our beliefs and ideologies about language as well?
So we heard all of you talk and share this idea that a cultural shift is needed in understanding of language study in the classroom, and that we need to consider what language we as teachers bring about language to our educational spaces. Some teachers are doing this deep work with their language positionalities already, but many of them are doing them in states that have English-only policies. And my question would be, how can researchers, teacher educators, and teachers subvert these policies within their classrooms in order to disrupt the standardized norms of languages, like languaging?
I mean, I can start off with this one since I was very excited about the question. I live in Florida, as you all probably know, and I tend to refer to Florida as ground zero for a lot of what has been happening nationally and has been spilling over, unfortunately, in international sorts of spaces. As you all probably know, a lot of the countries, such as the one I come from, St. Lucia, we rely on, or we look to the U.S. for a lot of the ways that we engage with English literacy and with ELA practices. And so I think that's one of the questions I found to be quite important for not just teachers, but for teacher educators as we work in our different spaces, whether here in the U.S. or, as I do too, work in our Caribbean spaces. How can we subvert? When I saw the question, I thought, it's easy for us to look at the Englishes and say, this type of English is you know, it's oppressing me and it's creating a challenge for me, so I'm going to push back on it. I think we've done a lot of the resistance work, which, you know, I believe it's necessary work, right? The resistance work is necessary work. And as I've written, you know, in my book with Cambridge, I talk about coming to an understanding of how we have been dichotomizing a lot of these conversations to think about this one is bad, this one is good. How do we locate the politics of this conversation in its source, as I mentioned earlier, and think through lenses such as critical race theory about the ways in which white supremacy, you know, a long time ago by the European subject, has positioned certain types of language practices as necessarily superior, and therefore they're intertwined connections to a certain person as superior as well. How do we disrupt that ideological position, but allow individuals to realize that the abstract named language itself is something that you are going to engage with, and different types of people with different types of personhoods engage with these practices. And so differentiating this notion of the source of inequitable power relations that are created and how we become subsumed within it, and also this idea of, you know, the abstract languages. So to answer this question, I would say that, yes, we do need to challenge English-only policies, right? But how do we do that without necessarily alienating the very students? And I think here of African-American populations, for instance, who use English as their, or English is, you might say, as their default mechanisms for engaging with translanguaging, and how they can tend to be alienated because they've never also been part of the translanguaging conversations either. And so I think about populations that can become alienated in this conversation if we look at it from a dichotomous perspective, and how do we come at it by creating imaginaries, again, that bring me back to censoring multilingual, multicultural, multiracial norms. So we've done a lot of the resisting, and arguably we've made a lot of progress. And I'm saying, let's have a parallel stream of creating these imaginaries. What does it look like? I call them liberatory Caribbean imaginaries in my work, to show how we can begin to structure, restructure, reimagine, rethink schools, and maybe even disregard standards that do not necessarily help us to see how all different types of named language practices can be, in fact, part of our translanguaging repertoires, legitimately functioning and allowing us to exercise our personhoods. And at the same time, being able to say, yes, there is oppression, there is racialization. How do we do both? How do we hold both truths? I call it a both and navigate those truths in ways that allow us to design the futures that we are hoping our students and our adults 10, 20 years from now will be able to inherit.
I appreciate you, Petrian, really challenging us to not engage in work that's going to perpetuate binary approaches to language education, because to what end? Again, that kind of comes back to it. And I think about the work of cultivating these imaginaries that you're talking about. That's at the heart of what we can do as teachers, and, you know, thinking about these practical approaches that teachers can do to resist and also exist and persist within the structures that are shaping our schooling experiences with children in schools. I think about the daunting work ahead for us as educators, teacher educators, researchers in this work. And I want to emphasize that I think we have to abandon this idea that the onus is on one teacher to do all this work in their classroom and make it happen, and really begin to think about building solidarities among teachers, with families, with administrators, with state policymakers as well. We want to hide because sometimes we feel scared that we're going to get in trouble, given the context that we're in right now. But as a way to cultivate these imaginaries that you're talking about, Patrian, we do have to go public. We do have to, and doing that in a safe way, in a way that, again, builds solidarities. And the partnerships right now that I have the pleasure of engaging in right now with teachers, they're finding everyday ways that they are together have helped to sustain and develop, sustain their practices towards translanguaging, towards translingual literacies, but also develop their own beliefs and ideologies about languaging practices. It's not about having a weekly meeting, but it's in the everyday ways that they're encountering one another. Oh, I just shared this book and this is what unfolded, and someone uncovered more about their linguistic repertoire that they didn't know before, or this conversation emerged as well. So how, you know, one of the ways that teachers can, I think, again, begin to resist and persist in the system that we're in is look for collaborations that are generative and can really sustain and develop their practice and beliefs as well. Don't be alone.
I couldn't have said it better. I just want to respond and say thank you so much for saying it in this way, Angie, because, you know, being in Florida, I've had to learn that we will not survive through resistance if we are not creating sustainable imaginaries that can fill our souls. I think you mentioned Holly with joy and hope, and give students hope, give teachers hope. I realized, I mean, this is what, probably year three for us in Florida dealing with this. And people ask me, how can you be in Florida? And to be quite honest, it's because you are building imaginaries that allow students, not just for future, but in the present moment, while you still are naming the truths about what is happening, you're still always building these imaginaries. So I just want to say thank you for making my heart happy by putting it in this wonderful way. You know, teachers need hope in these kinds of spaces. And the way we do that is to create these, new defaults is what I call them, new default mechanisms for operating.
That for me, methodologically, what's been helpful with that is to draw on practitioner research and work with teachers, like not just expect that this work is, that they're necessarily doing this work on their own, right, on an island, that instead that I can come and partner with teachers to think about the conditions of possibility that we could construct in their classrooms, and that I have a role as a teacher researcher to do that work with and alongside them. And then on another end, I also think about this through my work with pre-service teachers. We have so much possibility, and like it's a wonderful chance to work with people right as they're starting out, and have classroom time and space to think about theory and reflect and learn critical pedagogies while like first starting out in the classroom, right? So it's such a time of hope and optimism. So I've done some work with a graduate student colleague, Katie McGee, thinking about having pre-service teachers examine their orientations and stances towards multilingualism as part of their coursework starting out. And alongside that, also critically learning about theories of literacy, curriculum, so that whatever school they end up in, there's some of this initial work, like they're on that trajectory towards critical reflexivity, right? And we don't know exactly what context they'll end up in. But hopefully we've started to develop some of the tools of reflection, learning about their students, and bringing critical pedagogies, culturally sustaining ideologies into the classroom space from the get-go.
I'll add on to what Lindsay said and talk a little bit about working with teachers, and particularly pre-service teachers. I think one of the things that I found is most powerful when we talk about centering joy and excitement, and it's really seeing the responses of students that I feel like has been the most powerful thing in shifting their pedagogy forward. And so it's just, you know, when I sort of, you know, put up the theory on, you know, the PowerPoint slides and whatever, like, you know, I feel like that's, you know, seeing sort of them engage in this practice-based assignments, this practice-based work coupled with the theory is so much more powerful, because when they see students and being affirmed and the ways in which they respond, like, that's when I really start to see them reflect on these ideological shifts and in so many important ways.
I think I'm tempted to just jump in again and say, Goldie Muhammad, joy, joy, joy. And like just thinking with some of that work and how teachers need that joy too, to be able to do the work. Teachers need to feel, right, that they are making progress. And I've seen it too, Faith, in my work with teachers. The thing that moves them the most is seeing that the interventions or strategies actually did help students to be able to show this beauty that they possess. And teachers are like, wow, what? How did we do that? Oh, and I'm like, yeah, this is basically what we're talking about. And so we can show teachers and maybe hopefully policymakers and administrators that this stuff actually brings out the best in your students. And then it also helps students to be able to do all the things that you think they should be able to do over here prescriptively. I mean, you're basically, you know, nourishing the full self of the child and building the full linguistic repertoire. So I totally resonate with that, that you just shared, Faith.
Wow. Thank you all so much for joining us today on this episode of Inquiring Minds, focused on translanguaging as we build imaginary through conditions of possibility. And we have thoroughly enjoyed hearing from these amazing scholars and know that our listeners will as well. Thank you.